Blog Talk Radio.
I tell you, clapping always melts my heart, and hopefully it melts the snow as well. Welcome, people, to She's Raising the Bar Blog Talk Radio, coming at you for the past 9 years. Wednesdays at 1 o'clock. Wait a second. Wednesdays at 1 o'clock on the East Coast, 10 o'clock on the West Coast. So to everybody listening on the West Coast, East Coast hates you right now. 70 degrees. We're not having that. But we'll catch up in the summer. We'll love you again. And we have a nice following in the UK, where it is 6 o'clock there. And hello to Vicky Garvey, who listens every week from there. And she has a nice glass of wine with us as we're on the air. So welcome, people. Thank you for joining us. If you're a first-timer, we hope you stay a little bit. And if not, this is what I always say. Been on the air for 9 years. You might say, you know what, I had enough of that. Come back. We might have something you like later on. We might not, but welcome aboard. And to all the people that have faithfully joined us, thank you for staying with us. Loyalty is absolutely wonderful, and it's paramount with me. So thank you for joining us. Well, needless to say that this is change. And I always say, and those of the people listening to the show know I lean very left, there's always going to be a reason for one group of people to celebrate and one group of people to grumble and complain to anybody who's listening. And that's fine. I think what we have to really figure out now is how to do it the way we used to do it. You just, at parties, you just don't discuss politics, you don't discuss religion, or you understand the temperature of the people you're engaging with, and you know where to stop the conversation. So in saying that, I'm always amazed by people that are going to, and I always wonder why people change and decide to jump in a political arena. Now, Joe Biden made no, he wasn't secretive with the fact that he jumped into the presidential race because of what was happening, what he saw was happening. And what he saw was happening was not, and again, I've been a Democrat most of my life. I've always voted along party lines. However, I'm open to other people's suggestions and philosophies. That's fine. But what we've had for the past 4 years was really not a difference in policy. It was a difference in, it was something that wasn't even recognizable to a lot of people. And some of my Republican friends said the same thing. They didn't understand where this was and that it seemed very unhealthy. And that was Joe Biden's reason for jumping in. And I'm going to say, I'm sure there's people are saying, you know, to the contrary, happy he did. My guest today threw her hat in the arena for Staten Island Borough President. Now, should she win, and I'm thinking she will be the first female in that borough. Now, anybody in L.A. probably doesn't understand the enormity of what I'm saying, so I'm going to give a rough sketch of the boroughs. Staten Island, and I've had my businesses out there for 10 years. I'm a Brooklynite, and met so many lovely people along the way. But the temperature in that borough tends to be a little bit more leaning to the right than to the left, although there are people that are just wonderful, and I've met more people that I've loved than not in that borough. But being on the Democratic ticket is definitely a task that's going to need a lot of night sleep, a lot of vitamins, and a lot of protein. And that's what Lori Honor is going to be doing. And we welcome her to the show today. Lori, welcome aboard, darling.
Lori, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure.
How are you doing with all this? Did I freak you out with the enormity of what you're going to be doing, what you're undertaking?
No, I don't think I. Maybe I'm just in my little quarantine cocoon, and I think like, oh, this is going to be easy. Everybody thinks the way I think.
You know something? What was the pivotal moment for you?
I think it's really cool that you mentioned Joe Biden, because I was not a supporter early on. I was a Warren, and then I was a Harris supporter.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And then President Biden, of course, I got behind him. I think he's going to do amazing, and I'm really grateful for, Vice President Harris representing. So I think their model definitely spoke to me as far as, like, sort of the excitement, even in an older white man who's not my typical, go-to choice in a candidate. I think what he's able to do in delivering in his cabinet, in his inclusion, in his new language, that he's, an older guy who's really the language of the culture, right? Whether it's the Black Lives Matter, whether we're talking about social justice, whether we're talking about trans rights or immigrant, whatever the things that really matter. I think the progressive movement has given him a real education, and I think it's very authentic for him to adopt that. So coming from an island, Staten Island is very, I would consider it from an insider's point of view to be, having some growing pains with its own identity, but also identifying, like, those language markers, those cultural markers are also being adopted very more readily than the public would think here on Staten Island. So I think going back to your question, what made me do it is because I want Staten Island to continue to push to be a little more on trend, both culturally and politically. And it's not a heavy lift. There are some amazing, as you said, there's some amazing people here. And I just think the narrative that's being told about Staten Island is not necessarily the narrative that I know or represent or participate in.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting, because I know you were part of this movement, 2017, when the inauguration happened, and I always consider it Black Friday. I remember everybody, there were buses going to Washington, and I actually marched in Manhattan. My husband and I did together. And I think what really moved me is the fact that I'm 58, so I wasn't around for a lot of the heavy pushing of the 60s. I saw it on TV, but I, of course, wasn't physically involved. And I remember getting on the trains, particularly in Brooklyn Heights, and the train being mobbed that Saturday, and everybody's there with their placards, everybody's there with their kids.
Right.
Women with their kids and their husbands, and there were women in their 80s with signs that said, "I didn't know that I was going to have to do this again."
Right.
And it was one of those moments of my life I'll always remember, because you're like, my God, this is what it was like. This is what it was like in the 60s, and people just said, "This, we can't have this. We have to peacefully protest as we always should." And I remember marching that day, and I was getting texts from one of my assistants at the time, and she was texting me the pictures that her sister in London, who was out with her daughters, and you realize every woman was marching that day from every place around. And that, I think, was something that excited and frightened me at the same time, because I thought to myself, wow, the rest of the world realizes we're up against something that we should be afraid of, and we have to get out and collectively push against it.
Well, I think your point is really interesting. Of course, I know that we were out there. I was in D.C. and, but it wasn't just like people in, women in America. It was like this was a worldwide phenomenon that women knew we're going to get to this point. This is no surprise to me. This is no surprise to any of my friends. This is no surprise to too many. Maybe there are, there are women that do not represent the best interests of other women. Women are responsible for, women being subjugated to, patriarchy for, they've stood in step with, with men who would rather oppress than accept. So it's not like we're this monolithic, group that just is all the same. But I think the majority of women knew that this was coming, knew that this insurrection of the six, the participants of that, that's why we have, the Violence Against Women Act. These are people who are capable of, incredible insidious, from microaggressions to, breaking into the Congress. I think it really begins and ends with, with women identifying an abuser.
Yeah. And knowing they have the voice to do so. And, your point brings me back to, I'm a little older than you, but I'm sure you remember this. Many years ago, the whole OJ trial. And I remember being on 42nd Street at the time, and people were gathered in front of that giant screen, and we were waiting for the verdict to come in. And I remember that it was racial divide, and people were cheering on one side and people were grumbling on the other. And I said to myself, what we don't realize, it had nothing to do with race. It had to do with women being told for centuries that it's not rape, it's your husband. Your husband can't rape you. You're your husband's property. It doesn't matter. And people turning a blind eye to all of that and a deaf ear. And I remember it hit me then. It's like, why can't all women see this is what it was about? It had nothing to do with race.
Well, I think it had a ton to do with race. I'm just going to say, I think I've learned recently that especially the trope of the white woman and the black male as a as a predator, as a potential danger, I think that I'm not going to speak for the black community, but I understand in a way that I didn't previously understand, and this comes with the engagement of Black Lives Matters and how different think now, not just about our own behavior, but about the cultural, the culture as a whole has shifted enormously since the inception of Black Lives Matters with the murder of Michael Brown in St. Louis. So I think as white allies come around, there's so much, I'm going to say all the buzzwords. There's just so much intersectionality right now, where all the allies that are on the right side of things seem to know that they're able to either face uncomfortable truths about why they weren't able to intersect before, or they're able to sort of accept and say like, okay, I see that you're trying. Come and join me, and we'll work together, right? And that's sort of the beautiful thing about what the Women's March did, and what it sort of started. It really opened up the need for allyship, the need for agency, and the need to look around and find other identities that are going to, that are going to be there to join you, because we could not do this on our own. We started
Absolutely
it.
Not.
I believe that we started it with the Women's March. on a, or continued it. I don't want to say we started it because there were other movements that were in, you know, active.
Of course.
But as far as like the enormousness of what it was like to commit to flipping the house, commit to getting involved in politics, commit to identifying right from wrong and standing by the collective like moral conviction that we were, you know, that that is the, you know, I don't even want to call it American because I would hope it's just humanity, but you cannot claim moral high ground and support a moral behavior.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that the thing that people have to realize about this march, and I've had arguments with women who said, well, why do, it's a women's march, why are men here? And you have to realize that the civil rights, all the movements in the 60s and the civil, was our progressive-minded brothers walking alongside of us. And that's really what, it's not just about one group. It's about everybody supporting the cause. And we work with them when they, and that's, people don't realize that. Well, people say, you know, the Black Lives Matter. Well, all lives matter. But you know what? Nobody is excluding you. People always think that because you're supporting one group, you're exclusionary to another or you're not paying attention. And that's really not what it's about.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the Black Lives Matter movement for me was the epitome of what an inclusive movement is. And it also was an example of how to get behind people and not try and, like, not try and, like, I don't want to say fix something, but, like, to take a lead. Like, these kids and these women and these activists on the whole for Black Lives Matter in my community, they were the epitome of how to run a beautiful, inclusive, and appreciative movement. They were so calm. They were so kind. They were so well regulated. Like, no, 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 don't say that. Like, no, 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 that's not cool. Like, it was just, and these were all young people. They did not grow up in a movement. They just knew what the right thing to do was.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? I was at Angela Davis, who was considered Nixon's public enemy number one, in like this when he was serving. We went because we had a mutual friend that knew her, and we went to see her speak at a gathering, and that my husband and myself and our band played there. And I was talking to her later, and here's this woman, eloquent. She's a professor. She has several children's books out. And we were talking about, you know, Donald Trump getting in January of that year. And she was saying that she had a great niece that came in and said, is Donald Duck in office now? And Angela said, we wish. And I was looking at her saying, this is a wonderful woman who was, you know, militant in her stance, but certainly never volatile, never, there was never anything that this should, this woman should have been public enemy number one, but yet Nixon declared her that. And this is just one of
the
things.
Well, how could not? He represents, she represents
everything of course.
That white America is afraid of, a powerful black woman who is claiming her agency and moving her people, you know, along. That is very much what is happening now with the vilification of, you know, the quote unquote, the squad. They are doing nothing but advocating for a better America, a more inclusive more inclusive voices and better policy for everybody. You know, I mean, if anyone represents the Christian ethic, it's them. They're not, you know, they're, I mean, I'm only saying Christian ethic because of the, you know, the links to the, you know, the white evangelicals and that are proposing to be, you know, on the right side of things. And yet they're inciting violence against women and worse, violence against women of color.
Yep. Exactly. And there's a story that I always like to tell because my brother-in-law is an ex-cop And we don't have certain discussions, my husband and I, because it's just going to go to a very bad place, and we've been there before. But there was a time that I had an altercation with a cop in Brooklyn Heights. I was sitting on a bus stop. My husband had just gone out to get bagels, and I'm sitting there, and it's after work, so I'm dressed with my briefcase, blah, blah, and I'm sitting there doing some work. Now, I was at a bus stop. All the cop had to do was tell me to move, which I've done in the past. So, again, not knowing what this man came away from, and again, their job is a lot harder than mine, he stuck his head in the car and screamed at the top of his lungs to move the effing car, blah, 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 blah. It went on and on, but needless to say, the sound of his voice and the scream could have parted my hair on another side. I don't react well to that. So I got out of the car, and I said everything that you don't say to a cop, everything. So you could imagine, no high school diploma and 5'2", this is the best you could do, everything. And he told me to get back in my car, and I told him, yeah, you're not my husband. Your name is not on my birth certificate. I pay your salary. You don't tell me what to do. It escalated. I took his badge, and I told him, you're in Brooklyn Heights. There's a lawyer watching, I'm sure, right now. You really want to do this? Now, he got back into his car after being sliced verbally from me, and I didn't get a ticket. Had I not had green eyes and a light pigmentation and dressed and had my briefcase with me, it would have ended very differently. And I know that.
Well, of course. I mean, you have no further to look than Sandra Bland, who was the tape of her assault is horrible and it's horrifying. So, yes, there's a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of there's a big difference between, you know, not supporting, you know, I support the police. I look at those Capitol police officers and my heart was broken
God.
For them.
Did you see that?
And how confused their organization must be that they're like, wait a minute, you're the Blue Lives Matter crowd and you're spitting on me, attacking, cursing me. Like, this is where I believe the police come to realize that we are all together. We want people to be law abiding, you know, and that doesn't mean that we're not in favor of, you know, proper policing of all communities. It's it's so disingenuous. It's such a childish, it's so easy to understand that you can be, you know, pro law enforcement and anti-murder of innocent people by bad law enforcement. I mean, I think that's just as plain as it gets. There are, you know, it's just stop. Just, I can't even have one more second of bandwidth for people who cannot understand that most people do want to call the police when there is a police emergency, but they do want accountability, transparency, and reform when it comes to overreach. And any documented occurrence of, you know, that's been in the news for the last, you know, since the murder of Eric Garner in my community in 2014, I think.
I remember.
I mean,
14.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is about building back, you know, community. And that's the work I think I'm really excited to do here on Staten Island, just to bring it back home, because I think that, you know, that saying that all politics is local is extremely glib, but it is when people make it local. Like when you look at the news or you look at things that affect you in the news and then you try and extrapolate, well, how is this represented in my community? Right? Like, so whether it's Black Lives Matter, so just for an example, you know, there was a march in my in Tottenville, which is the most conservative, arguably the community. So Staten Island, just for those of your listeners who might not understand it, is a very racially diverse and but there is a divide. So we have a large, we have about 450,000 people, but it's density and the more urban area where I live is called the North Shore. And then the more country area, the very suburban, even though most of the island itself is single family homes, there is a more of a time, sort of a small town vibe that's associated with this, with the South Shore. There's a reason, you know, that's very complicated and we probably don't have time for, about how people came from Brooklyn to Staten Island to sort of get away from what they were perceiving as urban issues, meaning that they did not want to integrate their neighborhoods. So we have a history
of... White flight. I'll say it for you, white flight. I know exactly what you're saying.
Right?
Yeah.
So we have a history of people coming here to be, you know, to live a certain kind of life and to have certain kinds of expectations. It's a lot of civil servants, so it's a lot of cops, firemen, nurses, and teachers. Like, so good union guys, right? And then, you know, but, so as a union member myself, I'm always baffled that, you know, I can't look at anything that I have in my life and not point to the union that gave it to me.
Thank you.
Right? From my father working for the fire department, you know, coming home stinking like smoke and with a bad back and drinking martinis to take the edge off his, you know, 36-hour shift. You know, my grandparents came from Italy, and my grandfather worked for the Singer Sewing Machine Company, and he was a union guy.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It's the sweetest thing. I remember as a kid, you know, my grandparents didn't speak English. My father, my grandfather was, he came over when he was 14 years old by himself and started working and scrapping to send money home. And I always think, like, what the? 14 years old, how bad do things have to be for you to send your kid over or for you to have to go? And then how brave. You know, I think of my grandfather as like this frail sort of old man. And then when I think about his origin story, I think of how, I mean, I can just get a little choked up just thinking about how brave, you know, immigrants are, right? So that makes me think about immigration. You know, I relate everything. I feel like I'm, remember in Star Trek, there was, in the Next Generation, there was the empath, Diana.
Yes.
She could just, she was like a super psychiatrist. Like she could just like feel everybody's feelings and relate to everybody. And then she would give this like very measured response to, you know, what was going on. I am like that person in my family. Like I cannot stop feeling the feelings. So everything that happens makes me feel like how it relates to my family. So when we talk about, you know, politics being local, to me, they're in my body. They're in my genetics. They're in my ancestry. Because if you're really, if you're really plugged into being a good human or a human, you know where you came from. You don't forget. Like, you don't pull up the ladder behind you, number one, and say, "Oh, I got mine," and that, or that's different. Like, you don't. You just say, I can't think of my mother coming over as an 8 or 9 year old girl, not knowing any English. And then with her little dark hair and her little black eyes and her, you know, her little olive skin and her scrappy little, you know, knees. You know, I just think of my mother as every immigrant child. And how
and
can we say
whole...
that? Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, no. That's your point. How did we, and we all come from immigrants, all of us, so how could we say it was okay because we got in and our ancestors got in, and now it's not okay to get in? Because I always say, and again, I was raised strict Roman Catholic, true Christians would be at the borders with water, blankets, and compassion. We don't block.
You know, there's nuns, those liberal crazy nuns that we all, like, I grew up with them. It was like, they're all there.
And that's the thing. That's the, you know, but again, and to your point, I think a lot of people have become single feature voters, and it's like I got mine. I don't want to. I don't want to do anything else. Don't raise my taxes. And my thinking is, if you raise my taxes, and people always worry about socialism, if you have to raise my taxes because a child to be fed better, raise my freaking taxes. I'm good with that. I have no problem. It's called being a good human being.
Yeah. I don't. I think the other thing is there's just so much. There's real misinformation and ignorance and stubbornness. Like, you have to be open. You have to have a flexible brain. Your brain has to be open to understanding new information, and then you sort of recalibrate. I think people's I'm surprised at people's bedrock beliefs being rooted in something that is so unproven, right? So your bedrock beliefs are, you know, they're coming for our jobs, right? That's just not true. So if you disprove that, then why can't you just rethink, like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Or I'm very confused about people not accepting factual information. And I think that goes into, like, the misinformation that has been going on in the last, I don't want to say the last 4 years, because I think it's gone on further.
Of course.
Since the inception of, like, talk radio being snowfed.
But think about this. The dog whistle being many, many decades ago, they're going to come and rape our women. This is the same thing. It's just tweaked to be modified into our dialogue. And that's what we keep doing. So the question is, how do we stop doing that? How do they stop doing that?
I think it begins with representation. Like, when you have more people of different cultures and communities and different faces and different faiths and genders and gender identities, you're going to be moving that culture along rather quickly. I think of it so my passion is gender equity and gender equality. I've worked for the ELA for the last 3 years. Getting the Equal Rights Amendment passed through to become amended, and that, by the way, is a byproduct of the Women's March and the Trump era. I'll just give you a primer, if you don't mind, of where the Equal Rights Amendment is right now. So after the Trump election, after Trump won the election in 2016, states started to really look at their states, knew where it was at. So they were like, okay, let's see how we can protect our people on the state level. And that way, any federal problems like the Muslim ban or detentions or ICE intervention or defunding Planned Parenthood, rescinding the Violence Against Women's Act, everything that we knew was possible, the states were trying to shore up. With that, Nevada, there's a woman in Nevada, her name is Dr. Pat Spearman, and she is a state legislator, and she decided that she needed to be she was always a passionate feminist. She said, she's championing the ERA. So she wanted to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed in her state. And her state became the 36th state to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. So then Illinois, under a man named Steven Anderson, he was a state legislator, a Republican, and he said he championed the ERA in Illinois and got it passed in 2017. So in 2017, Nevada, 2018, Illinois. And then it started to be like, wow, we're only one state away from ratifying the Constitution. So in 1972, when it was pitched, in order to ratify the Constitution in any way, in order to amend it, you have to get two-thirds of the states, rather, to amend their state constitutions. And so Phyllis Schlafly killed the ERA. Everybody was on board, right? In 1972 to 80, everybody was like, boom, 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 boom. ERA, who doesn't like equality? Of course, of course, of course. She comes along and says, oh, they're going to want to bad for the family. It's going to be bad for they're going to draft women into combat. She created this entire. They're going to turn women lesbians. It was an entire like any weird trope that you could talk about. That was her. And so she convinced the Senate and the House that she convinced states that that this was actually a bad thing for families and women, the ER, that equality was bad. men were just fine jumping on board. They're like, oh, you're a woman, you say it's bad, and you're going to sort of make us look okay by not supporting it. That was fine. So that's why ERA never got past the 36 states. We needed 30. We needed 38 to ratify. So we never got. We were hung about 35. Nevada comes. They become 36. Illinois comes around. They become 37. And then we're looking at Virginia. So I get on board with a bunch of women in Virginia that have been doing amazing work, and we decide. There were 13 states that had not yet ratified, and so we were like, all right, I think Virginia has the best shot. So I threw everything at Virginia, and I became their director of outreach in one of their grassroots organizations. There were many, many organizations, but I think ours was the most aggressive. It was called Virginia Ratify ERA, headed by Katie Hornung, who was an amazing grassroots organizer. So we ended up flipping Virginia. In 2000, we flipped their entire state house. Virginia became blue in 2019. The first order of business was to ratify their constitution and pass their ERA. And then less than a month later, this is February of 2020, Congress voted on the ERA and it's hard to say they passed the ERA, but what they did, because the ERA was already passed, it just needed the states to remove the deadline, because there was an arbitrary deadline ERA, and that said you had to pass it by this date, and it was sort of like unconstitutional. It was deemed inappropriate, but so the Congress in 2020 voted to remove the deadline on the ERA, and now it had to go to the Senate. Well, it sat on Mitch McConnell's desk for the last 10 months.
Of course.
Right? And
oh,
they weren't.
Jesus.
So here's the reason why it's important to get involved in the state races. Because we turned our attention on Georgia, and we, again, with a million other people, put money, time, and talent into Georgia. Thank God Georgia flipped. So in January 5th, Georgia flips. The reason we're hearing this impeachment trial right now has has the majority. And so, you know, as far as the equality quotient, the ERA will be voting, will be voted on by the Senate, and they will be voting to remove the deadline. And then, you know, in a few years, we'll be enshrined in the Constitution as full-fledged human beings.
Human beings. You know, and I always, you know, I try to honor people's belief. You know, all my sisters, if they don't agree with me, that's fine. But I want to understand why they don't. And I always wonder, how could you be a woman and not be a feminist? How is that humanly possible? And I go back to my godson's girlfriend who decided she was going to keep, they have a beautiful daughter who's about 12 now. And I had my reasons for thinking they should go on with their education and their lives and postpone pregnancy. And she said to me, you know, Aunt Lori, and she was 18 at the time, I don't believe in abortion. And I said, well, and I said, tell me why. And she said, because the church doesn't believe in that. And I said, the church doesn't believe in premarital sex. So you already lost the argument. But her thing was, I'm not a feminist and I'm not you. And I said to her, you know, you could wear your jeans the way you want. You could wear pants into church. You can eventually, when you're able to get a credit card, you could get a credit card on your own without your husband signing off on shared property.
Thank God
he
for
just
Bella
didn't get it. Bella. Oh, amen.
I have a cute Bella story.
Please.
So
she's my hero. Go ahead.
She's my hero, too. I love her.
I love her.
So just to, for your audience, I think what you were alluding to was Bella Abzug was the congresswoman from New York who powered through the legislation in the early 70s. I don't know if it was 72 or 71, where until that time, women could not open up their own checking accounts, couldn't have a credit card in their own name without their husband's permission. So you mentioned that, but you didn't actually say that it was not policy. It was not allowed.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, when I was in my 20s, I was living in Soho, and I was walking down the street, and I saw that Liz Abzug was running for borough president. And so I was like, oh, that's cool. She lives right in my neighborhood. Let me go walk in and see if I can volunteer. I had no political experience. I really didn't know very much about anything, but I knew that I was interested in helping, and I thought this would be a cool way of doing it. So my first day, I get an assignment. They're like, oh, good, whatever, I'm here. On my first day, I get an assignment, and it's me and Bella Abzug and her body person, who was named Tiny, and she was this big, gigantic woman. And it's me and Tiny and Bella in a station wagon. And we get in, and so we go up to the Upper West Side, and we're doing, passing out pamphlets, and we're doing, street work. And because I was, I was a very gregarious kid. I'm still considered a pretty gregarious person, but I was working, I was working in Bloomingdale's and Bergdorf's and Barney's. And I would Saks, and I would grab people and women and spray them perfume or get them to take their makeup off. And I'm like, if I can get somebody to take their makeup off in the middle of Saks Fifth Avenue, I could pretty much,
you're good.
Get it to do anything. And so, so Bella and Tiny were the ride up. I don't remember what we were talking about, but I remember that Bella Abzug was the most charming. She was really interested in me. Like, she didn't talk about herself. I mean, here's a woman who I could have been grilling. And she was just the most, interesting, what are you doing? What do you think? And what do you want? And it was just a lesson in, humility and equality. I was a 24-year-old kid, and she's, a 60-year-old icon. And she's treating me like an equal, but also trying to get to know me. It was just a lovely, lovely day. Thought I did really good at canvassing.
Did you happen to get going off topic here, but still on topic? Did you happen to see, for my 2 years ago for my birthday, John took me to see Bella with Harvey Fierstein.
It was on
Broadway. It was, Lori, it was amazing. And the thing about it that I love the best is he came out as himself. He didn't try to feminize himself in any way. He was Bella Abzug, during an election, locked in a bathroom while everything was going on outside. And you know what? It didn't matter. He was her. And the brilliance of this woman, and, again, we take things for granted because I always say, well, you know what? This could have happened. These were the women that were pushing when the pushing was hard. Things were a little easier for us and not great, but these were the women, the Gloria Steinems, these were the women, the Angela Davis, that were pushing in a way that we can't possibly understand. And they made way for us. And it was just a wonderful hour and a half, and it was probably one of the best shows I've seen on Broadway to date, easily.
Well, there were two things. I wanted to see that, and I wanted to see Gloria, about Gloria Steinem.
Gloria
but
Steinem,
I did see What the Constitution Means to Me, and that was just amazing. I'm actually pretty good friends now with the director because I tied the the Broadway show into the ERA. It was an action that we did. So we had Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney did a talk back after the show. She's the sponsor of the Equal Rights Amendment and a personal, you know, like I have a crush on her. She's a really wonderful person.
Yeah, but, no.
I want to say, remember when we were talking about why don't women represent their, you know, their best interests or, you know, how can a woman not? Gloria Steinem has a great quote. She says, women have two choices. Either she's a feminist or a masochist.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
And it's, you know, there's a level of not self-loathing among some women, but really unlearning. There's another quote, I can't remember, but it's something like learning isn't the problem. It's like unlearning. So I think that's where we are now in our culture. It's not about men and women not learning. Like, we have to learn a new thing. It's like, we have to unlearn these bad habits. Yeah. We have to unlearn this intolerance. We have to unlearn, you know, the habit of fear and this other thing that it's called, I call it othering, like making somebody so different that you can then hate them because you've dehumanized them so much. You've made them so other, right?
I agree.
Staten Island.
Go ahead. I told you it was going to be. Go ahead.
I was just saying, you know, trying to pull all those passions of mine and all that good work that I want to do. I don't have a problem representing a point of view that is different than many people on Staten Island. I find that it's like, that's dinner time. That's conversation, right? That's what we used to do before we didn't talk to each other, right? Before we didn't talk to each other, we used to talk to each other and argue a little bit. It never got to the point where, you know, you didn't want to, you know, that was my dinner time conversation. I was raised family, but in a very argumentative family. Like, we would just argue about everything. I think it's like maybe it was an Italian family. Yeah. But my father, who was, he was like an Italian wannabe. He married my mother, who was a first-generation immigrant. He tried to speak Italian to my grandparents, which was the most charming and adorable thing.
Aww.
He was so sweet. He really wanted to. He missed
That's
that
love.
Part of his He really did. He loved those people, and I really was very grateful for that. But my dad was a very he was just an, you know, we used to call it the arbitrary no. In my family, you had to started with no, and then you had work to do, and you had to, like, really work to turn that no into a maybe, and then a maybe into a yes, and that was just regular conversation. So I'm sort of hardwired to work with people who don't necessarily agree with me. And I can, I feel like I can do it in a very agreeable way because that's how my family interacted.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the whole thing. I mean, we could all preach to the choir, but it gets us nowhere. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes, and I always end the show with it, from Mother Teresa is, if we have no peace, it's because we've forgotten we belong to each other. And I think that that's kind of what happened the past 4 years, is we realize that, you know, we're on such, the divide is so great, and there's just so much consequence in disagreeing with somebody, that it just, again, some of my families were Democrats, some of my families were conservative, that's fine. But the argument was, at Easter dinner, politics out, leave everything out, just sit down together, and you know what, take it outside if there's a disagreement. But you don't have to throw a table. You don't have to throw a dish. And I think we are in the mentality of throwing a dish and then some.
Yeah.
And that's got to stop.
I don't love the jargon, like, it's time to lower the temperature. It's time to come together. Like, I feel like we have to find out, like, what's our shared, like, what do you, I think empathy is really the that we're just going to find more people who are, what do you care about? Like, and we all care about our kids, care about, you know, having safe communities. cities. We care about, you know, make our futures. I think that there are examples out in the world of cultures mm-hmm. and communities that have gone through worse than this and come
Absolutely.
Out okay. So I'm hopeful that in my own little community of Staten Island, we can mm-hmm. really find like a group thought that really makes easier for us, you know, not to walk away, not to flip a table, not to. I think that there are extremists that I just never want to. I just feel like they're beyond my scope
yeah,
of
yeah.
skill.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think most people are not extremists. They just no. are lumped into the same crowd. So I'm going to say, as a Staten Islander who wants to represent all of Staten Island, I am mm-hmm. really dedicated to figuring out, like, what would make everybody happy, right? Wouldn't it be mm-hmm. nice to talk about that? Like, what would make you happy?
Yeah.
Instead
yeah.
of, like, what's wrong with everything? Like, what would make yeah. you happy? Like, if we could just start phrasing things in a way
mm-hmm.
that would not just be positive in a pie in the sky, but first of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with being positive. So even
mm-hmm.
the idea that I'm talking
Never.
About positivity and sort of backing off of it, like what is so wrong? You know, like Elvis Costello said, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Peace, love, and
you
understanding, know, it's, yep. yep.
It's pretty
exactly.
much it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and you know what's
like
interesting?
Sort of my field. Like what is so funny about peace, love, and understanding? I'm down with it.
Yeah. You know, and again, when you think about it, we're all we have. We really are all we have. So if we don't make it work, there's a very, 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 very deep problem. And you and I were talking offline, and I did a good amount of speaking on Staten Island. And there were times I spoke at women's groups that kind of shared my view. And it was like, you know, just sitting there having a drink and talking to a bunch of girlfriends. And then there were a couple of times that I had people that, women that really were not of my mindset. And you know your audience. You look out and you scan the crowd and you realize, no, this is probably not either of our comfort zones. And I would start the dialogue by saying, okay, show of hands. How many women here have 7 tattoos? Am I the only ones? And that would create a laugh. And that opened a dialogue, because if you recognize the difference and you could laugh at it and say, look, I'm doing this, you're doing that. I ride a motorcycle, you don't. It's cool. People put their shoulders down and they're willing to talk to you. But not everybody wants to do that.
There's this great book that when I was studying sociology, there's a book called Bowling Alone, and it's about mm. how the decline of volunteering and different social
mm-hmm.
groups as, you know, as women became more in the workforce and people
yeah.
needed to work 2 jobs and the economy mm-hmm. got harder and it got harder to, you know, to sort of not be working. So one or the other
mm-hmm.
was happening. You know, more women were entering the job market. People were busier. They were working more jobs and they had less time to volunteer and join different social groups that kept their level of engagement up. They were engaged in the community and they were engaged with each other. And the sort of analogy of Bowling Alone, the name of the book, was sort of like
mm-hmm,
the last bowling, the last of the bowling clubs where you're just like basically bowling
yeah.
by yourself. Nobody's
yeah.
there, like bowling leagues or anything anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what the Trump era did was really reinforce people's sense of community. Like people found
mm-hmm.
each other because they wanted to do good work together. So on the one side, we're all siloed in a way. I hate that term, but it is sort of like appropriate.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
all the people who believe a certain way have formed groups and all the people who believe another way have formed their groups. And now I feel
yeah.
like it's time to start figuring out, like, maybe we don't need our groups to be so specific anymore. Maybe we need to reach
mm-hmm.
out into little bit more. And I think that's where the point, I think that's what, where Biden comes in. You know, he's so not an extremist on either way, but I think he really is representing his values. So I think he's uncompromised in his views, but he's also able to understand that people who, that you need to reach out to people who don't agree with you, and people who don't agree with you have to figure out how to get things done. So I'm very hopeful to use certain new models, even though they're in old packages, like President Biden.
Okay.
He's sort of a new old guy. I don't know.
You know, again, he wasn't my first choice, but he's certainly a better choice, and he's somebody who's got how many years, decades of experience, and again, somebody who is who's trying to bridge the divide a little bit more, and that's that's what we needed.
I think
and
his
who's
experience
rational
on its face is not worth. You know, you could say Mitch McConnell has experience too, right? And that doesn't really matter.
That's
not.
I don't even include
it's
him.
Not, it's not valuable experience, or it's not experience that I think is valuable right now. I think experience like Elizabeth Warren's experience, like Joe Biden's experience, like Bernie Sanders' experience, right? I think people who have been morally in the right place their whole lives and now leads up to something that is both significant and needed. And I think it's the, you know, I think that these, not these elders, because they're not all, I mean, they're all pretty old, but I think, you know, that they're being influenced, their level of experience, I'll just take Bernie Sanders on his face. You know, you were talking about how people get involved in other people's causes. I mean, Bernie Sanders was in the civil rights movement from the time he was a man. So I see like that thread of continuity being very valuable. And then I see like a person like Joe Biden, who was not really on the side of, you know, Anita Hill, say he was very, unkind, but he came around. Right. So I think there's more than one right way to manage coming to the conclusion. So Bernie Sanders had this moral compass from the very beginning, and also this deep understanding of social justice, and was probably a little more radical in a good way. Joe Biden comes to his, you know, education slower, but he takes ownership of it. He apologizes for it. He does better, right? And then he becomes a better and more complete human. And I think that's what we need to expect out of people, that they not be perfect from the get-go, but that they be willing to, you know, to adapt and change and learn and grow. And, you know, then we can talk about peace, love, and understanding.
Yeah. And, you know, I've said from the beginning, I'm sure, I mean, we're all in a honeymoon period. We're loving him. But I know he's going to do something that I think is like I'm going to complain about. I know if there's something that has supreme consequence, he will come around and apologize for it, which is something that we have the template for the past 4 years. We didn't know that. We had a narcissist who would not take responsibility for anything. So, unfortunately, we've lowered the bar so that anybody tripping over it would have been better. But this man at least has a conscience and a heart and actually has a moral compass that really wants the best for everybody as opposed to himself.
I appreciate, I appreciate that. And I appreciate like the work of everyday people to make the climate a little, you know, we're talking about turning down the temperature, but I really believe that the climate of people who worked to sort of give voice to what we felt was, you know, both a dangerous possibility in sort of like the demagoguery of the Trump community. Right. I think those voices allowed us to develop like a real movement as opposed to just like individuals, you know, feeling terrified or disenfranchised but without any recourse. Right. So all those everyday people that showed up, everybody like really getting involved in ways that were, this is such an exciting time for people.
We've really laid a great track,
you know?
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to be among people again, hopefully soon, and sort of represent an everyday person in an executive leadership position.
Amen. And I know you have time constraints. It's 2:00. Before you leave the show, anything you want to add that I know you have a website that I want people to visit, and I'm going to certainly put it on my wall tomorrow. But give a shout out to anything that you think we didn't hit on with our conversation.
Well, I think that I would like people to know about Staten Island, that it's not what you just read in the newspaper, that they are really lovely, engaged, smart, passionate, just really decent people here that come from all over the country, all over the world rather, not all over the country. The funny thing is that I think Staten Island is so authentically New York and American.
New York,
made of, you know, so New Yorkers are here on Staten Island because nobody's coming here from like Iowa with a trust fund and moving to Staten Island. They're going to Greenpoint, Greensburg. But people from Staten Island are from Staten Island typically, right?
Yeah.
Now, is that if you're not from Staten Island, you're an immigrant. And so we are like, in my mind, my borough is the most quintessential New York because there's authentic New Yorkers here and there's a very strong and diverse immigrant population from Liberia, Nigeria, Jamaica, Sri Lanka, the people you wouldn't expect, right? Poland has a large population here. Of course, Mexican, Guatemalan, and Ecuadorian. So we have a beautiful food culture here. We have little Southeast Asian communities. We have small Mexican, Dominican food areas. So it's so much more diverse than you would think if you only heard, you know, you only knew about it from, you know, sort of the worst representation of it.
Of course. So your website, give it now. I'm going to give it tomorrow again. People are probably writing things down now.
It's Honor, H-O-N-O-R, which is my last name, Honor for BP. So spelled out, Honor, F-O-R-B-P, like Honor for Borough President.com. And we can use donations. We can use volunteers. If you're from New York, we would love it. There's an 8-to-1 matching donation if you're from New York City. So even if you give $20, it turns out to be multiplied by 8 and then plus your original 20.
So
your $20 donation turns out to be $180. So which is a great – the campaign finance board was formed so that people like me who are not trust fund people and don't have access to millionaires and super PACs, but who would make very good leaders, that they could be competitive and run a competitive and a professional campaign with the matching money. So when you get people involved, which I can do, they will reward me by giving me money.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Laura, you'll be back on the show.
Those are your tax dollars, by the way. Thank you, New York City Campaign Finance Board.
There you go. But you'll be back on the show with us, yes?
I would love to. Be so happy. It was a real joy and pleasure, Lori. I can't thank you enough.
It really was great. And everything, all your information will be on my page tomorrow and the show's page tomorrow. And again, we'll keep shouting out. And Lori, Anna, God bless you. Wonderful, wonderful time chatting with you. And Godspeed, my darling. Thank you for joining
you,
us.
Friend. All right. Thank you again. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Lori.
Bye-bye, darling. And there she goes. Lori Honor. But you know what? I forgot. She's got a lovely wine place, wine and spirits. We got so involved in stuff, and I knew this was going to be the case when we got on the air. But yeah, Honor Wines and Staten Island, the North Shore, and lovely. I've been in there actually one or two times. I didn't meet her there, but lovely selections of wines, bourbons, and what have you. And all her information will be on the page tomorrow. And I'm sure as her campaign progresses, we're going to have her on again. So you know what, people? What's coming up? Valentine's Day is coming up. And, you know, if you heard Alexis Hunter on the show, she was on, probably last month, and she wrote the book A Body to Die For, the Joe Lansing story. And she is also, in addition to being a fabulous author, a wonderful, wonderful artist as far as jewelry making. And I actually have some things that she made that I can't wait till this pandemic lifts, because I want to wear this stuff and I don't have the place to go. But when I'm on the red carpet with her and her book, I'm going to wear the necklaces that she made for me. But she actually has a, Com has a lot of her jewelry, bracelets, earrings, necklaces. Just look under Alexis Hunter. But you could actually even email her directly, and she will send you a link to the things that you want. If you text her and you say you want necklaces, she will show you what she's got available. It's msalexhunter@aol.com. msalexhunter@aol.com. And, you know, it's never too late to get somebody something for Valentine's Day. And if it doesn't get to you in time, you know what you can do? And I've done this in the past with tickets, you know, Broadway tickets. You could take a picture of what's coming and put it in the card and just say, this will be here in a week, because Valentine's Day is on Sunday, I think it is, right? Sunday. And, yeah, this way they open the card and they see that something is coming. And, you know, it's the gift that gives twice, because, you know, there's something really cool about getting a package in the mail. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but there's something nice about knowing something is coming for you. And a lovely card to put it in is a wonderful thing. So again, msalexhunter@aol.com. I'm telling you, the wider range of things that she's got is just amazing. So definitely check that out. I think you probably heard Cindy Dawson on our show last week, an artist of multi-layers, but a wonderful pub out in Jersey that as soon as I'm able to move the car, I'm going to get out there. And it's Mulligan's on First. And I was assured by her they could really make any drink, even the drinks that you only heard of in the 60s, because I mentioned to her that my husband's grandfather used to love a highball. And for some reason, a lot of the bartenders now don't know what a highball is, but it's really, I forgot the drink that you said it was, but they renamed it. So if you go into a restaurant now and ask for a highball, a lot of the younger bartenders won't know what you're talking about. They'll look at you a little tilt, but they know all these drinks and the drinks that were renamed. And again, Mulligan's on First, and they're out in Jersey. And look over their website. They really have a nice array of food, too. But sounds like the drinks are what you'd be going for. And thankfully, restaurants are going to be opened on Friday, 25%. But there's still a lot of people that want to do outdoor dining because they feel a little bit more comfortable. And that's fine. But you know what? This is a step in the right direction when you think about last year at this time. We had no idea what was going to be happening. And I always, you know, bring up the story. John and I sitting in our favorite place in Bay Ridge. And we're sitting there. And it was, had to be Saturday the 14th. And the waitress came over and said, you know, I want you guys to come over. On Tuesday, we have an open bar. And come in as my guests. And we were so sure we were going to be going there because it was St. Patrick's Day. We were positive we'll be able to go in. And before you know it, everything that we knew of had been a memory. So this is a nice thing. And people should still wear your masks. still be responsible, get vaccinated if you can. And you know what? If you can't be vaccinated yet, don't jump the line. Don't say you're a teacher. Don't say anything that's the contrary, because people who deserve to get vaccinated before you need to. So if you're healthy, wait your turn online, but definitely do it and wear your masks and wash your hands and do everything right as we wait for all of this to lift. That's our show. How about that? And in closing, I said it before, but I'll say it again, my favorite quote by Mother Teresa is, if we've forgotten that we belong to each other, no, if we know we don't know peace, it's because we've forgotten we belong to each other. So keep that with you as we walk into areas where people aren't wearing masks, people don't understand you, people are leaning differently politically or any other way. Just keep that in mind and keep a cool head, and we're all in this together. Next week, Angie Miller is going to be on with me, and she is a psychotherapist to the stars, and we're going to have a great talk about the shift in power and how a woman being second in command is changing the landscape for a lot of men who are starting to feel a little threatened. I don't want to give too much away, but it's going to be one of those conversations that I think everybody wants to tune into. In the meantime, go out there, make it a wonderful day, be good to each other, and I will see all of you next week, 1 o'clock. Take care, people.